The town may be kind of small, but these folks have big smiles and big hearts. And they know what it is to have simple fun down our way, where old-fashioned singing and homey gatherings make living mighty pleasant.
My picture went away. I can't see it. Yes, I see you guys.
You are now frozen.
But yeah. You're frozen with a smile on your face.
Yeah, you look fantastic, Rob.
Thank you, Keith.
So what are we talking about today?
The Russians.
The Russians. Blame the Russians for everything.
Game's rolling.
Welcome to Abandoned Albums, the documentary podcast where we take a closer look at some albums that may have been forgotten about over time, and some albums you might not even know existed. I'm your host, Keith R. Higgins. And joining me all the way from Staten Island, New York, is Rob Janicki.
Hey, Keith, how are you?
You know, Rob, thanks for asking. It's not often, and by not often I mean never, that I quote Paul Simon, but I will now. You know, Rob, I'm feeling groovy.
San Francisco was the back eddy of European civilization. These people haunted the waterfront and the Barbary Coast by night.
On this episode of Abandoned Albums, Matthew Stull, the co-founder of what is arguably the only new wave a cappella group in music history, The Bobs, swings by Thunderlove Studios to talk with Rob and I a little bit about how the group came to be and some of the more memorable gigs they've had throughout their career, as well as what's currently going on with him. So here's our conversation with Matthew Stull. So let's go back to the beginning, Matthew.
Yes.
The Bobs started with you and Gunnar.
And Gunnar, right. Gunnar and I met at the Western Onion Singing Telegram Company.
You and my father. Union was always onion to my father.
And so that's where we met. And I mostly worked in the office singing over telephones to people around the world sometimes. It was strange. And Gunnar was an in-person singer. So I only did that a few times, for specialty projects. But he would dress up in this little red Philip Morris outfit. That's how we looked. We had little pillbox hats. It was very retro, and white gloves and a little silver tray that had the printout of the singing telegram, and they would go and basically, start to sing. And we were all a bunch of pretty good singers. That's the thing.
Were you a singer in your youth? Is that something that you wanted to do, or a performer?
I was in my rock bands, but I was usually the singing drummer in those.
Oh, that's a rarity.
In my youth. And then I got the acting bug. A friend of mine in high school, I was kind of a jock, a little bit of a jock when I was younger. And I was not, it's 67, 68, 69. That's when it is. My friend comes up to me and goes, hey, I want you to join this. I want you to get out of all that fucking sports, all those fucking jocks, and come with me and be in this, it's like competitive acting thing. And I'm like, looking at him going, are you fucking crazy? What are you talking about?
Acting's not competitive enough?
No. This is like, it's like a high school against high school. Duets and monologues. It was part of the debate club.
Got it.
When we had those, I don't know if we have those anymore, debate stuff. Anyways, when we taught people to speak and to bring out their ideas. Anyways, let's not go there. He said, this was finally the argument that actually won me over in the end, although I did have a fight with my wrestling coach, which also got me out of the sports thing. So he said, look at it this way. We get to go out of town all over the state, and there's only 5 guys and there are 15 girls. And he goes, okay, you tell me, you want to be in a van with a bunch of girls or a van with a bunch of stinky jocks? You tell me. And I chose the girls, and So I got into acting pretty heavily and really, really enjoyed it. The teacher was fabulous. And then my dad was moved to the East Coast, and my parents, in their brilliance, really, I think, at the time, found a high school in New Jersey that had a theater program that had as much funding as the football team.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a different era altogether.
Yes, but it still has a very, very active theater program, Ridgewood High School. So I really went on from there, did summer stock. Then I went to my parents and said, you know, I actually don't really want to go to college. At that time, San Francisco was so hot.
Yeah, and this would have been 67?
Yeah, 67? 68, 69, in all throughout, and then into the 70s. Just so hot. There were so many theaters and so many little groups doing and just very innovative stuff, and that's where I wanted to be. So I told my dad that, and to his brilliance said, well, if you don't go do it now, you never will, so you better go do it.
Wow.
Yeah. My mother, on the other side, cried and called me a bum. But there you go. So anyway, that's what brought me to the West Coast. I was working as an actor when I started the Bobs with Gunnar. So Gunnar was playing keyboards for a singer named Amanda Hughes. And he was doing music for theater and stuff like that. He had graduated from UC Berkeley and... But right at that time, I was doing, I think I was doing Berkeley Shakespeare stuff at that time. So I was playing, you know, Petruchio and Hamlet and shit like that. And Gunnar and I ended up going to see this trio that was in the Bay Area at the time performing. And they're just doing covers, right? But they're doing it in a bit doo-wop style. And it's pretty cool. And the sound is fun. And they're a fun show. We thought, well, that was something, you know, we might do that, you know. Wouldn't that be a cool idea? And then I thought, you know, but we got to really be careful what we do, you know. I mean, doo-wop is, you know, who's ever going to be better than the Persuasions, you know? It's just not going to happen, you know. Sorry. Although we started singing a lot of cover tunes, in fact, tunes like, you know, Merle Travis, That Fat Gal of Mine. Do you know that one?
I don't.
She keeps me warm in the winter, shady in the summertime. That's what I like about that fat gal of mine. And when I see my landlord, there's so much of her to hide behind. You wouldn't pay rent if your time was spent like mine. She's so sweet with the softest heart. She's pretty soft around other parts. So at night when I lay me down, I don't need a pillow when she's around. Warm in the winter and shady in the summertime.
Can't sing that one anymore, but that was a hilarious one, you know. We sang all kinds of weird cover tunes in the very beginning because that's all there was. And we were looking at doo-woppy stuff because I had brought in a really bizarre doo-wop version of Proud Mary. But then Gunnar, guess what I love about art sometimes and music especially, is so I brought this one thing, which is a different idea. It was like a famous tune done in this style. But, you know, so, and then Gunnar said, well, how about we do this tune? And he brings out Psycho Killer, the Talking Heads tune. He says, why don't we just do this a cappella?
Rip, dip, 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 dim, bum, bum, ba. Rip, dip, 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 dim, bum, bum, ba. Rip, dip, 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 dim, bum, bum, ba. Rip, dip, 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 dim, bum, bum, ba. Rip, dip, 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 dim, bum, bum, ba.
First time we met Richard, Gunnar brought this out, and there was just like, oh fuck yeah. The idea is that we were looking for a different way to cover a song, how to capture a song without just doing it literally, you know? So, and that's what it was really about.
Was there criteria that went into selecting a song?
You know, we all had such a wide, varied, all three of us had such a huge, wide, varied life of music of all kinds of odd people and styles. And that I think that we were always just kind of coming in with lists, you know, I thought we could do, maybe we could do this one. And then in rehearsal, we'd go, oh, well, let's, if that caught the ear of the other two, then maybe that's what happened, you know. I mean, that's how we ended up doing a medley of Baby Snakes into Lonesome Cowboy Bert, these two Zappa tunes. It's just great because, it was super, super hard to sing, but that was because we all loved Frank Zappa. We were all three Zappa fans. So when that came up as a suggestion, we went, oh yeah, fuck yeah, we should do a Zappa tune. Of course we should.
Every time I've talked to somebody about music, whether it be on the podcast or just in general, and they talk about starting a band, instruments are always involved. Always. I've never, like, so okay. I'm curious. Yeah. Well, how does it, well, how are there, were instruments ever a consideration at all, like in the beginning, or was it just right from the get-go? No, we're doing it this way.
Right in the beginning, it was absolutely, we're not going to use instruments. And here's the reason. Gunnar was in a band. I had been a drummer. And Richard was a bass player. And he was playing, you know, all over town with his bass. And an engineer as well. So we decided that, okay, wouldn't it be great not to have to carry this shit with us? Just all we show up is with a microphone. You know, and here's the story that explains it all. And it was the perfect one. So we're playing this big festival back east, Fox, forget the name of it right now. Anyways, we're going on, just before, Lyle Lovett and his large band, who's pulled into this thing with like three tractor trailers, right? The stage is just awash with shit. And the stage manager and the sound guy are like, they got their hands on their heads like this. And they're just like, they can't, oh God, oh my God, what a headache, all this stuff, you know? And I was carrying the bag that day. It was just a little bag. It was, you know, I don't know. It's about the size of a laptop with three there was four of us at the time, four microphones in it. That's it. That's all it is. Really? Right. So I walk up to the stage manager. Hi, I'm Matthew. I'm with the Bobs. And we're here to do our sound check. And he goes, oh, okay. Whew, all right. I can do it. We just finished with Lyle. And he's looking over my shoulder like, you know, where's your stuff? And I hold this bag up. And he goes, and his reaction, he just looks me in the eye and goes, I love you guys.
Definitely a sound person's dream. There's no doubt.
We were loved by sound men. So
it's just pure laziness that made you go with acapella.
Mostly pure laziness.
It's a familiar object. You've seen one or its picture. You've never touched one. An elegant little weapon, beautiful in its dainty, snub-nosed wickedness.
Pretty in its way, Inspector.
Pretty and dangerous. Every one of them is capable of death.
One of the things that I was thinking about when we knew we were going to do this podcast, we've talked to people who have been in bands, different genres, you know, and different styles of music, being placed with other bands that they probably shouldn't have been on tour with or played for, right? Have you ever played in front of an audience who they weren't sure of, they didn't maybe understand what you guys were doing, or maybe expecting a band to come out with instruments, and then you come out, right? And what was some of the craziest fan reactions?
You know, that's pretty much the history for the first 10 years.
Wow.
we got asked, I don't know how we got asked, to open for the Grateful Dead at New Year's Eve at Civic Auditorium in San Francisco.
That is awesome.
And we were all like, sure. Yeah, of course. Yeah. And it was exactly the scene you would think it is. It's exactly the way you imagine it. So I think that that's one of the most interesting things. You come out on stage and it's just packed literally to the rafters. And there's like big balloons bouncing through the crowd. And you can tell there's this haze of smoke out over, you know, the crowd. And just like, oh, yeah. And everything's is very mellow. And you look out and
I think
everybody I've talked to who've done Dead shows have said the same thing. You look out on this crowd and they look at you like Jerry himself asked you to be on that stage for them. And you are just accepted with grins on the faces. And they just were in a very, very appreciative, friendly audience. And you're just like, wow, you know, that was nice. You know, you're like, you're just accepted. That's
incredible to hear. Yeah.
Right. You know, so.
Is there anything on the other side of the spectrum?
We opened for Zappa. And I thought it would be pretty much perfect. I thought we would just be a really great opening act for him. And we are, of course, the three of us, Richard, Gunnar, and I, were exceptionally excited. And I was down in L.A., and big space, Coliseum, I think. And we got there. We're all very excited. And everybody's on stage rehearsing, and they're going through some tune. And it comes to the end. Then Frank goes, stop. And he goes over to the guitar player and starts, no, it's this, it's that. It's fine. And they're having this big discussion, heated discussion. And they start the tune again, and it comes to the same spot, and he stops it again. And he starts yelling at the guitar player, and they do it again, and and this keeps going on. And we're standing on the side of the stage, you know, with our mic bag, right? And finally, the stage manager has, you know, because this just keeps going on. Like this, they run through this tune to this point, and then Frank starts yelling at the guitar player. And finally, the stage manager walks on stage, and this is also when you go and perform with your heroes, right? The stage manager walks out, you know, whispers, you know, points over to us. We're standing. Hi, Frank. You know, these four geeks standing over on the side. You know, he says, oh, the Bobs need to do their sound check before the show. And we only have a little bit of time. And he goes, okay. Oh, fuck. And he just storms off the other side. And we're like, all righty then. So we come on, we get our sound check done. We're very fast, you know, sound check's done. We come off, we're in our dressing room, and also, you know, there's this knock on the door, and they go, oh, come on in. And in comes the guitar player. He walks in the door and goes, "Hi, man. Oh, I can't wait. I'm really excited about hearing you guys. I've heard a bunch of your stuff. It's so cool. My name's Dweezil."
Wow.
And I'm like, oh.
Wow.
Nobody says anything. We're just like, oh, that's a tough. That is a tough. That's tough. But we were very, he was so nice and so gracious, and he was so friendly. We were very very impressed. So, and afterwards he was, you know, "You guys did really good. It was a tough crowd." Oh God, what's a tough crowd. And that's where it comes down to. Were we a good mix with Frank Zappa? I sure thought so. Did his audience think so? Yeah. Not at all.
Oots, tss, oots.
Particle man, doing the things a particle can. What's he like? It's not important. Particle man, is he a dot or is he a speck? When he's underwater, does he get wet? Or does the water get him instead? Nobody knows. Particle man. Triangle man, triangle man. Triangle man hates particle man. They have a fight. Triangle wins. Triangle man.
So Matthew, then let me ask you, how did you get to be a quartet?
When we went from a trio to a quartet, when we added Janie, that was Richard and Gunnar as who ended up being the songwriting team. They were like, "We need a fourth voice, and we would like it to be like an alto woman." And we're like, "I'm like, okay, that's kind of cool, you know. I'm the more the guy who's the stage guy, and they're the, you know, the people making the music." My thing with them was that, you know, I could always stick in ideas. That was fine. But my thing was they always knew I would sing whatever song, however weird it was. They knew that if I'll have Matthew sing that one. So that was kind of my side of that. But yes, it was really great to get it. I thought it was not, you know, the quartet was the right. That was when it started clicking anyways, you know, and you could tell, I mean, even with my limited musical knowledge at the time, it was pretty obvious that three people, it's a hell of a lot harder than with four.
When you see a band live, right, a lot of the focus is usually on the singer. And if you're a guitar player, you can hide, but if you make a mistake and there's some distortion, you can kind of hide a little bit, miss a drum fill, right? But sometimes people aren't paying attention. They're watching the lead singer. All right. of you guys are lead singers. You're all singing. There's nothing to hide behind.
Right.
So was there extra pressure as a musician? Because really, if you flub a line, if you miss a note, there's nothing to hide that. That's out there.
Right.
Did you guys feel anything like that where the pressure
And the thing is that going back to where we come from, Richard and Gunnar are musicians. You know, I was an actor. Basically, Richard as the bass singer is the tonal center. You go to him, that's where you should be in that key, okay? If he slips, then everybody's having trouble. So I think as a cappella, yes, a cappella, you definitely, you really do have to concentrate. You're right. There's nothing to hide behind. If you screw up, you screw up. But here's what you find out is that most of the audience won't hear it. You'll hear it. I mean, there are many times when we walked off stage and went, "Wow, was that flat? Wow!" And you're like, and then someone comes, "Man, what a great version of that song! And I love that." And you're like, okay. And you realize that the audience is not as discerning about it as you are, right? They're not as picking up as much. And when you flub something, well, in a group like ours, in an act like we had, flubbing only was a license to go crazy. Okay, so and we used it often. We would improv and we would let it flow because you never knew where it was going to go. It might go someplace good. Sometimes, most of the time, it did.
As we age, our voice changes.
Oh, fuck.
And we can't, you know, you hear this all the time from artists that they can't hit the notes that they hit when they were younger. How did you guys address this as you went on in your career?
Well, luckily, because of the span of time, Richard's voice, in a weird way, actually got to be able to hit higher notes. And I settled probably more into a baritone than a tenor. I was kind of a tenor baritone when we started, and I was pretty much a baritone with some good falsetto stuff. You learn how to sing it differently. We didn't occasionally would drop a song a half step, you know, if it was not working anymore. And also because there were so many songs, sometimes it was just like, okay, it's time to retire that song. That song's from, you know, 30 years ago. You know, we don't need to do that one. We got 225 other ones to go through, you know, so.
Led to the Bob's folding shop?
I think for me, and I said this to Richard at the end too, is that I feel like the Bob's came together in a serendipity kind of way. And I think we ended in a very natural, we weren't angry at each other. There was no animosity. The thing is that we were, after 37 years, living in four different places in the country. I was still here in Seattle, but Richard had moved with his wife back to the family farm that he had inherited in Virginia. Dan and his wife had taken a job up in Minneapolis, and Angie was in San Francisco. So as we were coming up on that 37th year, I thought to myself, okay, this is not, to do something like this requires everybody to be incredibly on the same page. If a set goes out, you basically say, we're going to do 20 songs in a set. Here's 25 songs, right? Or 30 songs. And these are the songs we'll pick these other ones from, this set from. It requires everybody to do their due diligence and be ready to sing those songs. And that didn't happen on the first tour. And I realized that this distance, and I said, we can't do this. You know, if I'm sending out songs or we're suggesting songs to each other, we all got to know what we're going to sing. So we're not just coming out and singing the same 15 songs over and over and over. It's not okay with me. So we find, and Richard, and the thing for Richard and I, we already knew all these songs. This was, and Angie was really great about learning too, but Dan was having some personal stuff going on, and I think it became too much. And so we weren't, the shows were still great, but there was only so much music you were hearing out of the catalog, because there was no rehearsal process to force us to, okay, these are the songs we're going to work on. And we were just too far away. And so I said to Richard, and I could see Richard's been, you know, Richard's several years older than I am, and he's been on the road. He was a bass player from the time he was 14 years old. And so he spent a lot of time out on the road playing music. And he has this beautiful farm, which I've stayed at many, many, many times over the years. And I'm like, yeah, why would you want to leave here? Oh gosh, let's go out and make $250, or even if it was $2,500, you got to get out, get packed, drive to the airport, and you're leaving, you know, you've done that, you know? So I think that he really felt, and that it was, you know, he was like me. He goes, yeah, you might, you're right. It's perfect. Why not? You know, it's not there's really no drive to keep it going. And because we're not a kind of group who just wants to go back and do their old catalog over and over, it was obvious, you know? So
the time had come.
Yeah.
And there's no animus, and it's just like, All right, we're going to go and be friends, but that's that.
You got to recognize it. I mean, it's art, you know? You came together because of some energy, some time, something, where you all were, and that changes. Time changes that. So
100%.
Yeah.
And it's refreshing to hear that you didn't want to just be, you know, a legacy version of yourselves. You know, you wanted new music. You wanted it to evolve. And like when the bands that still tour do their same 15, 20, 25 songs, yeah, it gets old. You don't want to hear that. Like,
okay. All right.
Now, if I'm going to see a band, I will check out the set list. Yeah. Even before I buy a ticket, if they're playing the same set list night after night with very little variance, fuck it. I'm not going. I'm not going to spend 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 upwards to see a band phone it in, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't understand. I've known bands, and Joe Finetti ended up in, you know, the Diamonds, and that's exactly what they did, you know. I don't know how you do that. That would drive me absolutely insane. I would go crazy. I wouldn't last. So,
and I want to go back. I don't want to imply that these people phone it in, because I know it's hard work. And I want to backtrack on that a little. That's unfair. Yeah.
No. And you're right. No, but you're right. There's a mentality among some bands, especially an older band, a cover band, and they go out, here's the set, where this is the tour set. You know, maybe there's one change. Or, you know, maybe they'll, you know, but there's a tour set. I've known many a band that does that. So I just don't, I mean, that the Bobs were just not, the Bobs quite literally were incapable of doing that.
That's funny.
Energy goes both ways. It goes from the audience, and it goes, you know, from the audience to the band, from the band to the audience. And after a while, if the band's playing the same songs, no matter how good they play them and how good they sound, they're bored. They're bored, and the audience can feed off that. And they're like, then now we're bored, and it's just not it. Nobody wins.
As I've said to audiences many times, you're half the show. If we're not working together, it's not going to go. You know,
you're doing live shows again now.
I have a very good friend of mine who I brought on as an opening act for Bob's shows here in Seattle many years ago, and he now has come back and in retribution done the same to me, and asked me to be in this. His cabaret festival. And I'm like, oh, yeah, sure. Why not? What, you know, what is cabaret? I'm not singing. No, you sitting alone in your, I'm not singing that, you know, although I should, shouldn't I?
That's your next idea. You've got it. Yeah.
That would be funny. Actually. Yeah. That would be funny. No, what my act is, it's just starting. You might say. It's kind of halfway between theater and music. It's in the twilight zone between theater and music. So what it is that, like, it's basically I have this ukulele, okay? I'm not the greatest ukulele player. I admit this, you know. I never will be. You know, I'll get pretty good. I'm actually fairly good, but, you know, I'll never get, like, great. I'll never be Jake Shimabuku.
Well, who could be?
Yes, exactly. But, you know, my act is basically talking a lot about why I chose the ukulele over, say, another instrument like the banjo or you know, or the oud or, you know, some other instrument. And my act is hopefully never getting to actually playing the ukulele. That's my goal, is that I actually never really play a tune or sing, you know, that I just almost do that.
I like that.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. People are, because they're going to be wondering, all right, when does it start? When's it going to happen? And then you lead them on. And
I might have to end up doing one song. You know, I have to do one song that's really like, oh, that was so good. You know, after all that waiting, you know,
make them want to come back for more. Because exactly. Maybe next time you play two songs.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I thought, well, that would be different than you normally see in cabaret here in the United States.
This was great.
This was so much fun. It's really interesting to hear, you know, the stories, some of the stuff we've read, but now it's coming to life, and that's great.
The Bobs were wonderful in that respect. Well, we did sing pretty much everywhere too. I mean, we sang in a lot of odd places over the years, and some great things, you know. But
you know what just popped into my head would have been the Bobs at San Quentin.
Well, we did Folsom.
Oh, okay.
You don't get your bones until you do your prison show.
Well, fantastic, Matthew. Thank you so much.
Thanks. That was a lot of fun.
Thanks, man.
That was. Thank you.
That was great. Right. Thank you.
All right. Bye bye.
Adios. Awesome.
Many thanks to Matthew Stull and the rest of the Bobs. The songs you heard during this podcast were Fat Girl by Merle Travis, Psycho Killer, originally done by the Talking Heads, Done Here by the Bobs, Particle Man, originally done by They Might Be Giants, done here by the Bobs, and Disco Inferno, originally done by the Tramps, done here by Da Bobs. The Bobs album, The Bobs, Sing the Songs Of, is available to stream wherever you stream your favorite music. Abandoned Albums was recorded at Thunder Love Studios.
Produced and written by Keith R. Higgins and Rob Janicki.
Engineered and mixed by Steve Beasley. Edited by A.J. Royce.
Original music by Mike Pellegrino. If you like what you've heard, be sure to subscribe and follow us on social media. At Twitter, we are at Abandoned Albums, and on Instagram, we are at Abandoned_albums.
As always, thanks to Rob Janicki, S.W. Loudon, Nathan Sage, Steve Beasley, Mike Pellegrino, Therina Bella, and of course, our executive producer, Rufus Thunderlove.
And now, until we meet again next time, I remain as always obediently yours.
Abandoned Albums is a production of Station Road, LLC.